funeral, which is coming in on Friday. Sir. Hello, Mr. Sir, the romantic view. So this conversation is going to be a reiteration of points made earlier, but in educational psychology, we call that reinforcement. Students may feel boring, but go on. I spoke last time about the concept of the amateur and how 21st century perceptions of the term amateur do a serious injustice to the achievements of amateur performers and musicians in the 19th century and indeed in the late 18th century. I will remind you that the amateur was often a woman whose social constraints precluded any notion of public performance or the other associated behaviors of a professional musician who was a man. Indeed, the 18th century, in as early as the career of C.P.E. Bach, born in 1714, perceived the distinction between the professional and the amateur by two German terms, Kenner und Liebhaber. Kenner, those of you who study German may sense, is related to the verb kennen, which means to know. Ein Kenner was a professionally educated musician. C.P.E. Bach was a Kenner. So too was his old man and his brothers and sisters. So too was Haydn and Mozart. Liebhaber was the German equivalent of the French word amateur. It is typical of many German words, a combination of two separate words from Russian. Liebe, which means love, as in Dichter Liebe, on the one hand, and Haber, meaning to have or possess. Thus, a Liebhaber is someone who possesses love for the activity. How is that related to amateur? Because the word amateur comes from the Latin word amare, meaning to love. And an amateur is someone who loves doing whatever, does it for the love of the activity, not the expectation of financial reward. And as I mentioned, it is unwise to assume that there was a radical distinction between the proficiencies, the technique, the artistry of a Kenner and a Liebhaber in the 18th century any more than in the 19th century. And the evidence of this is, I think you will agree, rather dramatic. Here you have before you the opening of the page of the final sonata composed by Franz Josef Haydn. Sonata in E flat major, which many of you know is always anthologized in the subject of study, and at least one of you has performed. I direct your attention in this case, not to the content of which you're presumably in some instances already familiar, but to the following. So when this work was composed, in 1794, he was dedicated to Teresa Janssen Bartolozzi. You see the dedication there under the key signature, as E-flat major. Here, Teresa Janssen Bartolozzi, komponiert, 1794. Ms. Bartolozzi, Ms. Janssen Bartolozzi, and her sister were two amateur performers in London. There and composed at the same time as the third and third symphony, also composed for London, if you know. This piece is, as I'm sure Mr. Weibel can attest, since we know these he is typically, not easy, right? No, it's not easy at all. You may be absolutely certain that Franz Josef Haydn would not mess with an amateur by composing a sonata dedicated to her that she could not perform. You don't do that. You don't humiliate your patron, okay? File that away for future, you know. Whenever you have a patron, don't humiliate her, okay? It leads to unpleasantness and possible loss of interest. My point is that as you consider one of the most demanding, artistically and technically demanding keyboard works of this master composer, the 18th century composer of Haydn. You are also considering the virtuosity of the dedicatee, the one to whom the work is dedicated, a woman. So, file that reality away as we continue forward. Women in the 19th century, as I said last time, were the, in a sense, the focal point of much musical composition, because the music that was composed was music composed for them to perform. It was the house music, the parlor music of the 19th century. And a couple of years ago, in a very interesting essay review of a study of music making in the 19th century, the pianist and critic and historian Charles Rosen began with the following set of paragraphs, which I would like to read you as evidence to give you a more literary picture of this musical environment that was 19th century amateur music making and in social setting. Before 1900 in Europe and America, it was at home that music was most often experienced by family members who played some instrument or sang, and by willing or unwillingly, the rest of the family and friends. In Western society, among the lower middle class and upward, most music was made by women who were generally expected to learn to cook, sew, and play the piano. The majority of professional musicians may have been men, like a majority of professional cooks. But most of the cooking and piano playing is a lot of women. Music, like breakfast and dinner, was part of life at home. More exceptionally, music could be heard in some public places, concert hall, opera house, or church. The public realm was essentially a complement to the private. It set standards and added glamour. Notice that. Public music making was an accessory to house music. More music was made at home and was heard at home than in public performance. Rosen goes on, including a paragraph of this text. By the 21st century, all this had changed. Both private and public music are being displaced by recordings. Few people make music themselves at home anymore, because in more cramped living space, it is not inconvenient to house a piano, a once indispensable piece of furniture for any household with even modest pretensions to culture, an instrument that for more than a century was the mainstay of classical music. Outside the big cities, live public music is disappearing as well. Most of the smaller towns that used to have a classical concert series have lost that. And if they are too insignificant to sponsor a popular rock group event, their public music must be confined to clubs. Even live symphony and opera broadcasts have been largely eliminated. At home today, we play records. Classical and pop radio stations play records. And often ballet companies and theatrical productions play records in place of hiring musicians. So, our current experience with music is vastly different from that of the 19th century. And the notion of and the place of the amateur musician, which Rosen argues is basically vanished in the 21st century and actually vanished in the course of the 20th century, stands in stark contrast to the fact that the amateur musician was the mainstay of art music and was the mainstay of live musical performance in the 19th century. Very different world. Now, as I noted before, house music included chamber music of all sorts. Bonds, in his discussion of 18th century music, already introduces us to the distinction between the concert music and the domestic music, his term for house music. He also, of course, as I said last piece is a generic label. It embraces a wide variety of specific labels. And you have some of the more common of these specific labels identifying the character pieces in listening assignment number 5, specifically in the Gold Book on pages 52 and 53. These are names you all know. You're not being introduced to such terms as the bagatelle and song without words, or nocturne, or mazurka, or transcendental etude, or etude of any other sort or prelude. You know these terms. But nevertheless, they are all terms within the domain of the character piece, and they are by no means all the terms used to identify character pieces. How many of you are working on a character piece right now? You need some instrumental. Come on. Anybody playing a one movement word for your instrument and piano? Yes. Mr. Wildman, you're not?
It's unaccompanied.
One movement? Yep. 3 sections? Yep. All right, you're playing a character piece all by yourself. Well, man. Everybody here has played character pieces. If you're not working on one now, you're an instrumentalist, you will. Just as the singers have all sung art songs, and if they're not working on one now, they will. Mr. Gilligan, you're not playing a character piece?
No.
Why not? You're just too good for that?
No, I just heard that was material.
You sure? Okay. But you played character pieces in past that. A one movement work for saxophone and piano. With some poetic title. Yes. Think back, all of you who are instrumentalists, that one way or one time or another you have played repertory representative of this genre. Now, Barnes discusses character pieces on page 439, make note, in which he says of a character piece that it is a work of small dimension. It seeks to portray and explore the mood or character of a particular person, idea, situation, or emotion. Sometimes these are specified, sometimes not. The form of the character piece, according to a German musicologist, a distinguished German musicologist named Friedrich Blume, is derived from the minuet of the 18th century. The minuet, of course, consists of 2 rounded binary forms. The first one returns without repeat at the end, minuet da capo. Thus, the minuet and trio minuet da capo would be largely A, B, A. And so too, the character piece is primarily an A, B, A form. The other possibilities, as Barnes points out, are variations of this 3-part form, A, A, B, A, B, B. But A, B, A is the primary, that basic 3-part form. And we can see that 3-part form in one of the earliest examples of character pieces. A 1-page composition by Beethoven, which he referred to as a bagatelle. Here it is in 1 page. What's interesting about this particular bagatelle, it's the 5th of the set that was published as his opus 125. Look at opus 125. Bagatelles, for example. Opus 125. Who knows what opus 124 is? Yes, Mr. Clark. You don't know. Indeed. Anybody have an idea? Anybody? It's the Ninth Symphony. Hey, folks, you want to juxtapose monumental and miniature? Here you can. Opus 124. The Ninth Symphony, 2,000 plus measures. Opus 125, bagatelles for piano, which is one in 1 page. monumental, followed by mini. This is a work that reflects the tripartite minuet trio form. Let's check it out. You can see it yourself. Starting off in G major. Pronounced double bar here, moving to C major. Making its way back to G major. Interesting. Tonic, subdominant, tonic. Note the first half has internal repetitions, as you will hear, and is repeated this way. Here, there's a reference to the opening material, but no repetition, in the manner of the minuet da capo. This piece goes something like this.
So many
music for the virtuoso, the canard, the professional to play. Again, why? Because they were short, they could be brilliant, the audience would be dazzled in a short space of time. And no more famous composer or performer of such dazzling virtuosic character pieces was there than Franz Liszt. And you have, as part of your listening, one example, a transcendental etude. Transcendental because ostensibly it exceeded all the technical expectations of its time by all of its requirements of virtuosity. Virtuosity, of course, Franz Liszt himself could deliver quite easily and did quite regularly. But do note on page 53 that the Liszt transcendental etude is not for the amateur, but for the professional, as were all of his works. And many by others were equally commanded. There was a line beyond which amateur performers were unable to go in most instances, even though most of this music was written for amateur performers. Now, I want to share with you a couple of images that show us the place of amateur music making in Europe with reference to the visual arts. See if I can pull this transition off. This is a painting by the French impressionist, Auguste Renoir. It's a painting of his wife, Madame, seated at an upright piano, obviously in a very formal gown. Before her, music is open on the rack, this upright piano. Remember, Rosa was talking about how rooms get smaller and you don't have room for a piano in 21st century architecture. Well, of course, the upright piano and the spinet piano were efforts to make pianos fit into smaller spaces. They meant to be grand. This dates from the 1870s, and is one of a number of occasions in which Renoir painted members of his family. He had two daughters, both of them, too, pianists. And here we have a representation of the amateur woman pianist, of middle-class rank. You'll notice over here, we have a large urn and peacock feathers, suggestive of a certain amount of wealth. The brass candlesticks that illuminate the music, in theory at least. The oriental rug, suggestive of a certain amount of wealth, etc. Let's see if I can push this to the next image. This is also interesting because it reminds us it's not only Europe where such amateur music making was made. This is a painting by the young Picard Degas, another French impressionist. This dates from the late 1860s, but it is painted in his brother's salon, the French equivalent of the parlor, in his home in New Orleans, Louisiana. What is interesting about this particular scene is the two women are performing an excerpt from an opera. Degas' brother is seated at the piano. This is Degas' wife.
That is your brother's wife.
This is his mistress.
Things were a little tense in the Degas household. Yes?
Were they African American?
Nope. Mm-hmm.
No, they were French.
You're
all French. You're looking at the coloring of his
completely.
Yes.
Hair turn.
Well, we've been out in the sun. If anything, either that or HR was suggesting he was in shadow. But he was not African American. In any case, the point here is, regardless of the tension in this triangle, again, subject matter of 19th century artists included paintings showing amateur musicians at work. And here are two movies. Family was in disarray. Basically, the New Orleans family would fall apart. Luckily, the house, which is a museum now, managed to survive Katrina more or less intact. I saw it last October here in front of the University House. So here we have the European, and here we have the American images that were either shown to other images of American amateur musicians. As you examine books of American art in the 19th century, you'll find something else you'll find. And now what you are seeing are representations of musical life that Rosie described. Other questions?